Our next speaker is Chor Sung Koo, who is Vice President, Global Nutrition and Health, Campbell Soup Company.
We need to cross Moscow with cats, and maybe we can come up with an algorithm that will really look at how people shop and determine nutrition. Phil has talked about the Canadian experience. What I'm going to do is talk about the barriers to sodium reduction from a technical point of view, as well as also give you some examples from the U.S. Move forward. All right. One of the things that we know is that universally that sodium reduction recommendation is now in many, many countries. And most of the recommendations are sort of panning out to less than 2 grams of sodium intake a day. And what we're trying to do here basically is a reduction. Most of the baseline, if you look at countries around the world, could be between 3,500 to 4,000, depending on the country. And what we're trying to do is to reduce sodium between 1,000 milligrams a day or up to 2,000 milligrams a day, depending on the country. So it's a big challenge for the industry to take on the responsibility alone to try to help the consumer reduce sodium by 1,000 or 2,000 milligrams a day, because there are all kinds of issues that we face in terms of taste and in terms of experience. Now, globally, sodium reduction has been going on for many, many years, and many of the major industry companies have been doing it, but they have been doing it silently. They did it silently for a couple of reasons. One is they were very concerned about consumer acceptance of the products because the technology that we have right now, there's no silver bullet, there's no magic bullet that Moskowitz talked about. We don't have it. The other issue we face is regulatory, because they are constrained to how much reduction you have in order to make a claim. So when you have a 5% reduction, you keep quiet about it. But the food supply in the U.S. and in some of the Western countries has been going down, and many of the major food companies has been doing it over the last 20 years, but they're not talking about it. If you look across in terms of introduction of new reduced sodium product around the world, and this is from Mintel database, you find that the leading countries, the countries that are leading in terms of new product introduction, has been in the Western countries. But you also see that there have been, isolated introduction of reduced and lower sodium products in some of the Asian countries and also in some of the smaller countries. So what are the barriers? I can document 4 of them, and some of you may have more. But the key here is, one is the technological challenges that we face. The other one is that we don't understand much about salt taste mechanism in humans. We know a lot about what happens in the rats. We don't know a lot about what happens in the humans. So we're trying to develop technology based on no science. If you were a pharmaceutical company, you would never do that. You need to know the mechanism, your target, before you synthesize a drug. Here we are in the food industry trying to come up with a technology, not knowing exactly the basic molecular understanding of salt taste mechanism. The other thing we have is the regulatory constraint. I'll talk about that a little bit. And then the consumer acceptance and also the distraction. Now, salt, as we know, and when I talk about salt, I'm talking about sodium chloride, because most of the evidence on sodium relationship to blood pressure has been related to salt. So this is an important factor to distinguish. Salt, as we know, has multiple functions in food. It imparts taste, shelf life, preserves shelf life. It also affects the color, texture, and preservation. However, within sodium chloride alone, if you look at what role it plays in taste, it has multiple roles in taste. And here's an example that I tried to depict anatomically, beautiful color. Now, here's the challenge you face. Salt plays in so many different parts of your five senses of taste that when you try to reduce sodium, you will also affect, you will increase sweetness. You will at the same time increase bitterness because salt traditionally inhibits bitterness. And that's why traditionally in many cultures they add salt to vegetable, which tends to be a bitter and a product to start with. And then at the same time, it will affect sourness. It either will make it more sour or less sour. And at the same time, it will also affect umami, which is basically the body that you taste behind, it's the effect of MSG. But there's a lot of natural umami that comes from meat-based product. So the first thing is when you reduce sodium, whether you take it down by 200 milligrams or 300 milligrams, the first thing you have to do is you have to start balancing all the different flavor system because they are all affected at the same time. The other challenge we face is now that there's new studies, and Unilever has reported this, is that salt not only affect taste, it also affect olfaction. How you don't always taste the chicken, you actually do smell the chicken. There's an olfaction part of chicken. So when you reduce sodium, you do reduce the meaty smell of many of the product. So here's the challenge. The challenge is that from every soup, whether it's a vegetable soup or beef soup, you do not have the same blend. There's no one size fit all. Everyone is a balancing act. And that's why it's been so challenging for the food industry. The other challenge we face is that when you look at sodium chloride, Mother Nature has created salt to be the cleanest and the nicest flavors in terms of salty flavor. When you go down to potassium chloride, it only has about 10 to one-third of the saltiness of sodium chloride. So now you're really dealing with a big disadvantage with the number one salt replacement that you have. And then when you get down to the divalent salt, whether it's the calcium or magnesium that many people have reported, or even the amino acids, you now are down to less than 10% of saltiness. So in terms of tool sets, we are sort of always playing around to say, well, when you reduce this, you may add this, and you have to add the flavor back in. You have to also protect yourself from all the sweetness. So it is always an art and a science combined. And look at the price. Salt is very economical. In developing countries, salt is basically, and because their diet repertoire is so simple, that salt is one of the things that help them induce them to eat more food and therefore increase their calories, especially in countries that do not have a lot of food. So here's the question: every time when you do sodium reduction and replacement, the cost is going to go up. So the balance for the food industry is how do you come out with affordable, lower sodium products? There have been many patents that have been filed to date, over 80 around the world, and unfortunately, there's no magic bullet. Everyone is different, and everyone works differently. The other thing that I want to tell you about the sodium equation is you always think about sodium, but it's about salt. There are many different kinds of sodium salt that are used for other functional purposes, from sodium bicarbonate, which is what you need to make your Irish soda bread, to baking. And the challenge we have here is many of this sodium effect on blood pressure has never been studied. But we're assuming that these sodium salt will affect blood pressure. And we treat them as if they do, and we label them as if they do. And it becomes very challenging when you deal with a very low sodium product. When you keep reducing your sodium in a product, it comes to a point where you're going to need these sodium salt for functionality. And why punish this salt if you don't even have the research to know the relationship to blood pressure? We need more research. The other fact barrier we have is, like I talked about earlier, is we don't understand salt taste mechanism. We know a lot of studies from rodents. It's only recently that human salt taste studies are beginning to be funded, a lot of them by the industry. But in the U.S., a lot of our basic research funding for taste actually is when it's granted because they're studying taste disorder. And it's actually managed to the Institute of Deaf and Mute. Beats me. I don't know why that happens. I'm going to go through this very quickly, but it's only recently that we understand that salty taste is now all over the tongue. For a long time, we thought it was isolated to only a certain fraction of the tongue, but now it's all over the tongue. And the other issue that we face is a regulatory constraint. We right now in the U.S. and I think in some other countries as well, that you can't really talk about sodium reduction unless you achieve 25% reduction. 25% reduction is a lot of reduction, especially for a product, when you're trying to get the consumer to adjust to the taste. At the same time, on labels, all sodium salt are labeled as sodium salt. And we do, as I mentioned earlier, some of these products may not have sodium chloride, may just have sodium preservative in there to try to reduce listeria, but they are treated as sodium salt. Now, from a consumer perspective, which is one of the biggest barriers that we face, is that sodium is not top of mind with the consumer. She has a lot of distraction going on, and especially with the obesity crisis and diabetes, what she's interested in calories, fat, vegetable. So the thing is that when you come up with sodium reduction, how are you going to go through the clutter? And maybe Moskowitz can help us here, but certainly this is some of the things we have to learn the hard way when we did sodium reduction. If you look at this chart over here, you find that the consumer, number one interest is low fat, low calories, fat-free, cholesterol, and sodium. Only one out of three people are interested in sodium. So this is what, you know, how do you get through the clutter? And in Canada, this is the Canadian consumer are just as interested in taste as they are with nutrition. So again, when you talk about nutrition, you have to reassure them on taste. Now, one of the key things we found is that for the consumer, that when you talk about lower sodium, it's automatically in their mind, it tastes bad. And two, consumer will not accept a lower sodium product unless it tastes just as good as the product that you're trying to replace. They will make some exception, but not always, because they may trial it once, but they're not going to repeat. So the other thing is that if expectations are not met, they're not going to continue buying the product. And at the same time, consumer equates all sodium to be salt. And the other concern that we see is that many of the salt-sparing tools, like potassium chloride, sounds very chemical to the consumer, and they will try to avoid that. And potassium chloride is one of the major salt replacements that you have. Here's just an illustration of what we call the hedonic score, which is a sensory score that tells consumer can detect very small changes. If you go from 4-10, and then 5-10 to 4-10, you can see a big change in the hedonic score. They can detect it for some product down to 30 milligrams. So you have a real challenge in front of you, especially in a soup product, which is aqueous. They're going to pick it up fairly quickly within 10 milligrams. Here's just a chart that shows the hedonic score goes down as your sodium level goes down. You can see the purchase intent goes down. It's a linear curve. So just to give you some experience of what we have been doing, we have been looking at sodium reduction for 40 years, and by now we should learn something. We have been in this business for a long time. We started looking for salt substitute in the 50s, and realize there's no salt substitute. There's only salt replacement, and there's only tools that you can do to build around it. So in the 1970s, we went ahead and came out with lower sodium product. It didn't taste very good. It still doesn't taste very good. But this is the kind of product that's 120 milligrams. So David, bear in mind, this is the kind of product that took us a long time to get to where we are. We try all kinds of stuff. We put wine, we put, you know, chicken fat, everything you name it, it still doesn't sell very well. In the 80s, we went ahead and do silent reduction. We call it phantom reduction. We did it. And then we launch, we try a 30% reduced product, then went to 50% and realized that we don't know any, everything that we're doing is just an art. It's like trying to shoot into a bullseye and you don't know where the bullseye is. So we started investing in research. We did the 6 university research trying to understand salt taste mechanism. And today, as you can see, we started off in 2005 in the U.S. with just 25 products. Today, we have over 100 products that are sodium reduced, 50% sodium reduced. And this is now going globally. Canada was an inspiration for us and certainly taught us a lot of things about the consumer. And the good thing is that we started off with soup. We now have spread that learning into other products, into beverage, into breads, into spaghetti sauce. And our biggest achievement is the number one icon, the 125-year product, tomato soup. An icon you can't touch. You have to absolutely make sure that when you do a sodium reduction, because 25 million Americans use it every time. So in this particular product, when we did sodium reduction, we made sure that we tested that in 52 states. In every state in the United States, we make sure the consumer were happy about it. What did the consumer say? Are we successful? What did we learn about communication with the consumer to make this a successful experience? Well, 80% of the consumer who try our product rated the taste as good or better than original, which means it's a big win. Roughly two out of three consumer survey claimed that the lower sodium offering brought them back to buying the product, which is very important because that's what you want to do. You want to bring your consumer, your population back to believing that lower sodium product tastes good, and then they can actually follow the guidelines. Now, one of the key things that we learned is that when we did the product development, we're spending so much time in reducing sodium. It doesn't make sense to not also improve the nutritional quality of the product if it needs to be improved. So at Campbell's, we also look at other factors, other positive nutrients that could actually make the product intrinsically better nutritionally, and hopefully we'll get a better score from Katz's group. So as you can see, it is a success in the marketplace. In 2007, the Campbell Reduced Sodium was the number one pacemaker of the year by IRI. It's about, these are usually product that earns more than $100 million, which tells you that there's a ray of hope that there is a market for these kind of product. Because for a long time, the industry belief is that we are not going to invest a lot into it because there's no market. But if you do it right, there is a market. And I think many companies are beginning to realize that. So one of the key things, at least for us, is that sodium reduction is only a minor part of our overall wellness journey. And what we want to do is to be able to offer consumer not just reduced sodium product, but also in terms of all the other products that are suggested in the dietary guidelines. So that's basically the mission of my company. Now, what are the success elements that we learn? And because this will be important in terms of, as we talk about how can we make this successful, reassure on taste. Taste is king, pleasure is queen. So remember that. At the same time, when you're talking about this product, you have to, mention the fact that this is the same familiar product that they always use. Because if they think that you have messed around with the chunky soup and the tomato soup, no matter how well a science you have done, they're not going to buy it. Reassure them it is the same familiar food. Reassure them that it's just as good for the whole family. And, education is extremely important. Education not with the consumer, but also making sure the professional are educated on your product. I just came from the American Heart Association, and a lot of doctors will come to me and say, you know, 50% is still too high. You really need to go lower. And I said, so what is a good number, docs, if you were to talk to your patient? Oh, they say anything less than 100, I don't know, two digits, maybe single digits. So here's an education that we also have to talk to our physician about. Anything three digits is too high for the doctor. So we need to look at that. Now, surprisingly, this chart shows, is there a market for lower sodium product or reduced sodium product? And this is an interesting chart from Nielsen 2008. This is not counting the sales from Walmart. But for many categories, there are products where they either talk about sodium reduction or at least mention about reduced sodium, that it is a $15 billion market potential. So with that, I would say that for the food industry, that there is a rainbow for us to be more incentivized to try to look at lower sodium product. What have we learned? This is a lot of technical things that I talk about, but one of the key things that I think is important is that we are talking about trying to get the consumer to 2300. This is not going to be done overnight. We need to give our consumer time to adjust so that any policy that deals with reduction needs to give consumer time to adjust in terms of taste, the industry time to adjust to find the technology. Because this is not something that you can do overnight. We were very lucky with trans fat. We're not going to be so lucky with sodium. So as long as we know we need time, we also need each other to reinforce so that we do not have mixed messages for the consumer from a communication standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint as well. Yeah. So finally, what I'm going to talk about is that it is very important that from a standpoint of what should we do together, invest in more research. We can't do this blindly anymore. Two, open participation of government dialogues with industry folks, because the industry folks can give you a very quick assessment whether a dietary guideline can actually be realistically implemented instead of trying to, you know, force it on the public policy, and then you have a lot of finger pointing. So with that, I would again advocate government, industry, and our NGOs working together.
Thank you.